So if you haven't picked up the presentation, it's right up in front, so pick up a copy. So it's over. Almost. Thank you for sending in your summaries. Out of the 126 people in the class, I think I got 112 by this morning, so there might be a few that still trickle in. If you haven't sent it in, just send it in anyway, because I can put it into the final summary. It won't show up in the presentation, obviously. But before I start on today's session, a couple of reminders. One is the regular final is 1 to 3 in this room on Wednesday. Okay? Don't act surprised. Okay? Is it 1:30 or 1 o'clock? I forget now. I'll check. So if it's 1:30, it's 1:30. So if you show up at 1, it's better early than late. They show up at 1 for the 1:30. That way you're not going to be late. But I'll check and make sure. The early final is tomorrow from 6 to 8, is that right? 6 to 8. 6 to 8 p.m., 3, 1, 10. I was checking, there's a Google shared spreadsheet. Let me know when you're going to be taking the final. So let me know by later today, because I need to make sure that I have enough exams for that early final. Okay? But the Wednesday is the regular final. The review session was put up last Thursday. If you haven't watched it, watch it soon, because obviously you don't have much time. Okay? One final thing, if you do not do your CFE, you can't check your grade. And if you can't check your grade because you didn't do your CFE, don't email me. I'll not email you back. Okay? So, but here's the catch. You have only one day to do the CFE. It's tomorrow. The reason you don't have that extended period is because the final exam is so crammed up. So you have 24 hours, but it takes 3 minutes to do the damn CFE. So go in, do it. No, you can't do it today. It doesn't open until tomorrow morning. But as soon as it does, get it done, get it out of the way. So let's get started. What I want to do today is actually a combination of two things. One is I want to review the whole class. We didn't do that much anywhere. Actually, I'm kidding. We did a lot, but we'll try to do it. So what I'll do is I'll do a review because it's a good start to get ready for the final. I know you've been working on the project. You haven't had a chance to turn your attention to the final. So I'll do that first. And the second half of the class, I want to actually use to kind of take what you found in the project and feed it back to you. What percentage of companies came in undervalued? What percentage overvalued? Cheaper stocks, most expensive stocks, as you saw them. So let's get the show on the road. When I started this class, I said there were three ways in which you can value an asset. The first is intrinsic valuation, where you value an asset based on its characteristics, its cash flows, its growth, its risk. And let's face it, as you struggled with the intrinsic valuation of your company, you realize this was a combination of facts and estimates and guesswork and making your best judgments and being okay with being wrong. The second approach to valuation is pricing. We call it relative valuation, but you value an asset based on how similar assets are out there. And that, again, you recognize was a judgment call. Because when you sat down and said, what are the companies that are most similar to mine, you already saw that you had to make judgments along the way. And the third approach to valuation is applying option pricing, which didn't work for most of your companies, but where it did, it actually did. All it did was divvy up the spoils between those who rip off and those who get ripped off, equity investors and lenders, as we call them. Okay? So I thought about different ways in which I could frame this review session. And the way I picked is a little perverse. It reflects my twisted sense of this process. I drew from Dante's Inferno. You've heard of Dante? He's a twisted Italian guy. He was from the Middle Ages. Twisted in what sense? He actually wrote an entire book, thousands and thousands of pages, of what it feels like to be in hell. So I thought this would be a good way to present the common mistakes that people make in discounted cash flow valuation. Because if you think about it, the process is a pretty straightforward one. The value of an asset is driven by the cash flows from existing assets, which we compute by taking the after-tax operating income, subtracting out net capex, subtracting cash flows from existing assets, the growth rate during that high growth period, and the value of the growth is a function of the excess returns you generate while you grow, not the growth itself. The discount rate reflects the risk of your equity and debt going into the business. And what you get as a present value is the value of the operating assets. Everything has its place in evaluation. Your cash flows from existing assets come from your existing financial statements. The value of growth comes from the judgment calls you make about future growth. The risk shows up in your discount rate. The present value gives you the value of the operating assets. So with that in mind, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to take you through, actually you're going to go through, I'll just watch you go through it, different layers of health. So think of it as not that warm all the way to really hot layers. So I'm going to start with small sins and build up to really big sins. Okay? So I'm going to do it as a series of multiple choice questions so you can decide what layer of hell you want to get stuck in. Okay? I'm going to start with what I call the base year fixation. You know what that is? You act like the whole world started last year. You take that one income statement, one balance sheet, and you start building castles on it, not recognizing the fact that last year might not have been a great year to base your valuation on. So I'm going to start with that. Then I'm going to talk about taxes. Vastly misunderstood, vastly misanalyzed in valuation. How do taxes affect valuation? Where do they show in? When do you double count? When do you miscount? Then I want to talk about high growth. It's easy in a spreadsheet to let a company grow for 10, 15, 20, 25 years. I'm going to revisit the question of how long you can let high growth continue and when it has value. Then I'm going to follow up with a very quick review of all the things that can go wrong in estimating a cost of capital. I'm going to show you one cost of capital calculation with 10 mistakes in it. And it's actually not that uncommon, so you can basically tell me what those mistakes are. Then I'm going to ask you, how are you paying for growth? Growth is not free. Where does it show up in your valuation? Then I'm going to revisit the cost of capital, which we think of as one number, and talk about why and when it changes over time. In other words, you have a cost of capital up front in year one. Why would it be different in year 5, year 7, year 8, year 10? And we get to the terminal value. It's not an ATM. You can't keep going to it every time you need more value. We're going to look at the constraints you need to build into terminal value. And once you're done with the valuation, all the garnishing that goes on top of it, control premium, synergy premium, so very quickly go back and revisit those garnishing. And then once you get the value of equity, getting from the value of equity to value per share, you have all kinds of pitfalls in that process. And then I'm going to end up with what I call the bonus layer of hell. This is the hardest layer, which I'm going to rename the Wasserstein-Perella layer. Bruce Wasserstein is already there. Joe Perella is still with us. But they've created the layer of hell for those people who make those mistakes that deservedly put you in the hardest part of hell. So you ready? This is going to be a review for the final. So use this as a review because, as I said, every single layer of hell, I'm going to put a multiple choice question to you. And you tell me what I should do. So here's my first layer. You're valuing ExxonMobil. And let's say this is March or April of 2009. This is actually very similar to what you'd face today. Here's what the numbers look like from 2008. Revenues of $477 billion, EBIT times 1 minus T of $58 billion, net capex of $3 billion, change in working capital of $1 billion, free cash flow to the firm of $54 billion. So I've done the dirty work for you of computing free cash flow to the firm from 2008. The cost of capital for the firm is 8%. And use a stable growth rate of 2% in perpetuity to value the firm. It has $10 billion in debt outstanding. So do some intrinsic valuation. Don't need a calculator. Based on the numbers that I've given you, what's the intrinsic value for ExxonMobil? You have the free cash flow to the firm, right? $54 billion. Forget about the 1 plus C. How much difference is it going to make anyway? So you got $54 billion in free cash flow. Your cost of capital is 8%. Your growth rate in perpetuity is 2%. 54 divided by 0.06 is $900 billion. You subtract out the debt, you got $890 billion. The market cap of the firm is $373 billion. Something is definitely wrong here, right? Either this company is the biggest bargain in the face of the earth, or we're screwing up in one of those three numbers. And there are only three numbers in my valuation. So which of those three numbers is the culprit? Something is leading me to overvalue the company. Which of the three numbers do you think is the culprit? That's right.
The revenues, because oil prices were higher.
In other words, the free cash flow of $54 billion was the 2008 free cash flow. It's not a wrong number, but it's a number that reflects higher oil prices. By 2009, oil prices had dropped in half. In fact, this is a phenomenon that some of you face with commodity or oil companies that we evaluate, right? You looked at 2014 numbers as your base year. These companies all look like incredible bargains based on that. So the problem here is 2008 was an abnormally good year, and you see that reflected in the valuation. So what should you do? We've talked about the cyclical and commodity companies. It's not easy to do, but you need to normalize. Easier said than done, but you got to get past the most recent year and say, what do you think earnings will be in a normal year? And the answer, of course, can vary across people. You might use a 5-year average. I could use a 15-year average. You could look at the average oil price across a cycle. Whatever you do, though, you are trying to extend your reach beyond that base year. So that's the first stop. And anytime you do a valuation, don't ever use 1 year's numbers as your basis for your entire valuation without checking what the prior years look like, what the sector looks like. Always do that check before you start to value companies. Yes, Joseph.
That's fine. Really,
you know, it's exactly representative, right? Because that's exactly what you want as your value. Because what do you say? I can't predict the peaks and the valleys. I'm a long-term investor, which is the base of intrinsic valuation. I have to value the company for the midpoint, knowing that in every single year, I'm either going to be too low or too high. Exactly, right? So what you're doing is you're seeing numbers go like this, and you're smoothing out. So you know the growth rate is not 2% every year, right? But that's okay, because as long as the normalized income, that trend line goes up by 2%, your value is going to be okay. So you're going to be buying when everybody else is selling and selling when everybody else is buying, because you're the only one who's kind of not manic depressive in this market, who's taken your Prozac or whatever you had to take. That's what normalizing does, is kind of smooth things out. So with cyclical and commodity companies, in fact, many people say, how can you use a stable growth model? You cannot if I just go from year to year earnings, but I can if I smooth out the earnings. Okay. Now let's talk about taxes. And this is a purely mechanical test. Let's see if you can get it. I've given you the financial statements for a company. EBITDA, DI, EBIT, interest expense, taxable income, taxes, net income. I want to do a free cash flow to the firm valuation of this company. And I also tell you that the cash flows are going to be constant forever. And that's going to be relevant in coming up with the number. I want the free cash flow to the firm. And in case you've forgotten the definition, I've kind of written it out on the side. I don't see how you could have, but let's say you have. So with that income statement, what free cash flow to the firm would you use? And I'll give you the choice, and you tell me with each one whether this is the right choice. I could use net income plus depreciation. Yes? No? Maybe? What's wrong with that? First, it is starting with net income. So first problem. Second, you're adding back depreciation. It's kind of a half-assed cash flow, because where are the rest of the cash flows? Where's CapEx? Where's working capital? So net income plus depreciation doesn't work. EBIT, in fact, the first three numbers are all off the table because I'm just subtracting our depreciation. And I haven't given you CapEx. I haven't given you change in working capital. So what have I given you instead, though, that lets you get away from having to estimate CapEx and working capital? What have I told you about this company's future growth? There's no growth. And if you have no growth, what reinvestment do you need? You need zero reinvestment. I've just made your life incredibly simple. I've said, once you get past EBIT times 1 minus T, remember, reinvestment is net CapEx plus change in working capital. If you have no growth, reinvestment is zero. So all I need is EBIT net of taxes. Now tell me. Now that I've simplified the equation and said no net CapEx, no change in working capital, what's my EBIT times 1 minus tax rate? My EBIT is 100 million, right? My taxes are 32 million. This looks like a no-brainer. 100 minus 32 is 68 million, but that's the wrong answer. Why is it the wrong answer? Because I saved 8 million because of interest expenses, right? And I should not be counting that 8 million when I do the cash flows. Why not? because I'm going to discount back at the cost of capital, which already includes the tax benefits from interest expenses. That's why when you compute EBIT times 1 minus T, it's a hypothetical tax you're subtracting out. In this case, what should I be subtracting out? What's my tax rate? 32 divided by 80 is? Come on, you don't need to whip out your calculators for this. Remember your multiplication tables. 8 times 4 is 32, so that's 40%. 100 net of 40% taxes is 60 million. The right answer here is 60 million. It's the EBIT of 100 million net of taxes. Remember that when you see that problem on your on your exam or when you're valuing a company, never ever subtract out actual taxes paid from EBIT to come up with your after-tax EBIT, because if you do, you will double count the tax benefits from interest expenses. So the free cash flow to the firm here is 60 million because net capex and change in working capital is zero. Devendra?
Yeah, so just in theory, like if you did use EBIT minus taxes and then left out the 1 minus T, would you get the same?
You should get the same answer. Why make life? You will get the same answer when you have a stable, when you have zero growth model. When you put in stable growth, you've got to be very, there's a lot of details you've got to work through. So let me put it this way. Did everybody get his point? Which is, if you took the 68 million as your cash flow, but when you did your cost of capital, rather than using the after-tax cost of debt, use the pre-tax cost of debt, then you're counting the tax benefit once again, back in the cash flow. It's messy, though, to try to count the cash flow. That's why it's always better to count the tax benefits in your cost of capital and let the cash flow be a pre-debt cash flow. That's why we call it an unlevered cash flow. Think of it as the earnings you would have had if you had no debt. That's the best way to think about it. Because once you do that, it kind of cleans up the process, makes sure you don't double count. Any other questions on taxes? Now, that tax rate that I used here was the 32 divided by 80, which is really an effective tax rate. And that's okay. For earnings, you can use effective tax rates. For cost of debt, it's always got to be the marginal tax rate. Growth for how long? You sit there with this spreadsheet, you have a high growth company saying, should I use 3 years, 5 years, 8 years, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years? It's a graph I showed you before a long time ago, and you probably have forgotten it. But this is the graph of that study of IPOs, which compared the revenue growth at an IPO to the revenue growth of the sector in which that IPO was, 1 year after the IPO, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years. So let's review the graph. 1 year after the IPO, if you look at the revenue growth of the company that just went public relative to the sector, it's 15% higher. That's why we like IPOs, young growth companies. 2 years later, you look at that same company from the IPO, its growth rate is only 7% higher than the sector. 3 years after the IPO, the growth rate is now 3% above the sector. 5 years after the IPO, the company is starting to look more and more like the sector. You're saying, so what? Just a note of caution that when you sit down to value an Etsy or a Box or one of these young IPOs, you'd be tempted to say, look, this is a great growth company. I'm going to use 80% growth for the next 10 years. And this might, in fact, be the special company that's able to do that. But most companies, growth doesn't last that long. That's why 10 years is my limit for growth periods. It's not that companies don't grow for longer than 10 years, but when they do, they're more the exception rather than the rule. So keep that in mind again. It's not so much about the exam, but when you sit down to value young growth companies and you see 25 years of growth, 30 years of growth, 50 years of growth, you're really pushing the limits on how long a growth period can be for a young growth company. Never value a company to be the exception right off the bat, because then you have nothing, no upside left for yourself, because you've already valued it as an exception. Any questions? So now let's talk about the cost of capital. As I said, I'm going to show you a cost of capital calculation, which I actually took out of an actual calculation that I saw. I've changed the names of the companies to kind of protect the identity of the analysts involved. Okay. So this is actually a cost of capital calculation that I saw. There are at least, I think, 7 mistakes, maybe more, in this calculation. So as I go through, tell me, as I hit each mistake, tell me what mistake I made. First, let me review the calculation. So here's what the analyst did. There's a cost of capital for a company called Chippewa. It's really not the real name of the company. It's a U.S. technology firm that gets 20% of its revenues in Brazil. I know why that's relevant, but file it away. Here's the cost of capital that he computed. First, for the cost of equity, for the risk-free rate, he decided to replace the current T-bond rate, at that time at 3%, with a normalized T-bond rate, basically an average T-bond rate over the last 20 years. Okay? As I said, I'll come back and ask you what I should have done differently, so that's his first time. For the beta, he went to Bloomberg, right there next to a terminal, and he pulled up the beta. He did use the adjusted beta from Bloomberg for the company. For the risk premium, he used the historical risk premium from a service, in this case Ibbotson, which was a well-used data service, of 5%, and he added a small cap premium to it because it was a small company of an extra 3%. So you take risk-free rate plus beta times equity risk premium plus small cap premium, his cost of equity is 14%. For the cost of debt, he went looking for a rating, but the company was not rated. So here's what he did. He took the interest expense of the company and divided by the book value of debt of the company. It's called a book interest rate. The book interest rate he came up with was 3%. For the tax rate, he used the effective tax rate of 30%. So he took the book interest rate, that was 1 minus the effective tax rate. He used the market value of equity, so at least give him credit for that. But when it came to debt, he decided to be conservative. Since none of the debt was straight, he took all liabilities, accounts payable, supplier credit, all interest-bearing liabilities, and all interest-bearing liabilities, and he came up with another billion. So his debt ratio is 50%. So you ready? Tell me step by step what I would have. First, let's start with the risk-free rate. Do you agree with what he did? Or B? No. But if I'll play the role of the analyst. Tell me what I did wrong. Yes, Joseph. Tell me why. This is a conversation that many of you are going to have in a few months, because when you start working, I guarantee you this is going to come up. Risk-free rate is 2% now, not even 3%. Okay? So it is what it, but let's, you know, I need some more meat on this to kind of get this to sell. Jordan?
It reflects future expectations.
It reflects future expectations, but let me play devil's advocate. As the analyst, and all those other numbers like earnings and margins, I did replace current numbers with more normal numbers. We just did it with ExxonMobil, right? We talked about replacing the free cash flow from last year with a more normal value. What makes risk-free rates different? Why shouldn't I normalize just like I do everything else? In other words, if I use a higher risk-free rate, holding all else constant, my cost of equity and capital go up. Not a big deal. My value for the per share goes down. In fact, it'll probably go down enough that I will not buy these shares, right? Then what do? I have to invest in something else. A risk-free rate, unlike most other inputs, is actually the alternative I face today. I might not like the 2% rates, but that's what I'm stuck with. So when Janet Yellen said she thought stocks were quite high, those were exactly the words we used. Maybe somebody should have pointed out to her that interest rates are quite low. Because if your alternative is 2%, replacing it with a 5% is an extremely dangerous thing to do, because if you reject this investment, you're not finding that 5% investment. And the other response to give is, remember the factors that drive risk-free rates low are also playing out in the rest of your valuation. Where? When I get to my perpetuity, my terminal value, what do I cap my growth rate at? I cap it at the risk-free rate. So what one hand gives you, the other hand will take away. If risk-free rates are low because you're in a crisis, which is often the case, flight to quality, what else is affected by that same crisis? My equity risk premiums, my default spread should be higher. You can't just mess with one number in a macro variable and hope that everything else stays fixed. So that's the first problem. Second stuff, beta. I used an adjusted beta for Bloomberg. Tell me what I did wrong. Yes.
So aside from being a single company regression beta, they also...
Okay, stop with the single company. What's wrong with the single company regression beta?
It's not a good reflection of
noisy.
It's noisy.
Yeah. And can you put a little more, what does it mean when you say it's noisy?
the standard deviation is very high, it gives you a huge range for beta that is not...
You're right, and here's the story to add. All you need is one big event during the last 2 years or 5 years, and your beta is going to get thrown way off. And here's an example. You have a lawsuit against a company. For 2 months out of the 24 months, you had a lawsuit that pushed the stock price down. You know what's going to happen to your beta? First, give me a sense of direction. You have a lawsuit, it pushes your price down every day for 2 months. Is it going to increase your beta, decrease your beta? Maybe I should have put this on the exam. It'll actually decrease your beta. You know what? What does beta measure? It measures how you move with the market, correlation with the market. If you have an event that is company specific in either direction, that pushes your stock up or down no matter what the market does, it'll actually make your beta much lower. Merck's beta in the midst of the Vioxx lawsuits went to zero. Absurd when you think about it, but that's one reason why you need to avoid regression betas, and that's what we mean by noise, is anything that happens to the company over that 2 year or 5 year period can either push betas up or push betas down, and you have no idea which. So the first problem is the single regression beta. But what's the second?
I think that they adjusted.
So they took a screwed up beta and moved it towards one. So that's basically what they've done. So that's what the adjusted beta is. So what makes it any better than the screwed up beta? Right? So moving something towards one doesn't make it less screwed up. So what should we do instead? Rather than trust a single regression beta, use the law of large numbers. Which effectively means look across companies. That's the biggest reason for using sector average. It's not a religion, it's pure statistics. When you don't trust a single number, average things out. Because you can make this complex, but it's really multiple businesses, multiple betas take a weighted average. You get a much cleaner, more precise beta that can be forward-looking. How? If you're going to enter a new business tomorrow, I can bring it into your bottom-up beta. I cannot do it with the top-down beta. Let's get to the risk premium. They used a historical equity risk premium. What's wrong with that? In fact, everything we said about regression, single regression betas can be said about historical equity risk premiums, right? Big noise dumps, big standard error. It's backward-looking. What we'd really want is a dynamic, forward-looking, more precise equity risk premium. And one reason we went through that implied equity risk premium, we back things out, is it is forward-looking. We might not, you might disagree with my growth rate estimates, but it's a forward-looking number. The standard error on that number is far, far smaller. Even if you used a different growth rate on the S&P 500, the equity risk premium I had started this month was 5.8%, you might get 5.93%. Or 5.75. You're not going to get 7.5 or 3.2. So it's a more precise number. What about the small cap premium? People use it all over the place. Everybody uses it. It's horrible practice, but it's established horrible practice, which I guess makes it less horrible. What's wrong with the small cap premium? Okay, I agree with the country risk premium, but let's get rid of that small cap premium. What's the basis for the small cap premium? History. They used 85 years of data, and they said over the last 85 years, small companies have earned about 3.5% more than large companies. Done. The only problem is that 3.5% is a standard error of 2% associated with it, which means a true small cap premium could be 0, it could be 7. And in fact, I posted on this on my blog a few weeks ago. If you take the small cap premium, between 1928 and 1981, the small cap premium was 7%. Between 81 and 2015, the small cap premium is minus 0.18%. There is no small cap premium since 81. So if you're drawing on history, you can look at history and I can look at history, and I'm not sure the history backs up the use of a small cap premium. So same issues as with the historical premium, now magnified because you've added a small cap component to it. Could small companies be riskier than large companies? Sure, tell me a story about why small companies could be riskier. And it, you can, in fact, go back to the basics. What are the three things that drive beta? What kind of business are you in? How no? Discretionary is your product or service. Second is your fixed cost, and the third is your financial leverage. You could give me a really good story about what a why a small cap company might have a higher risk. It might produce more niche products, which makes its beta higher. It might have higher fixed costs. If you have economies of scale, and make its betas lower. I'm sorry, betas higher. And it might borrow more money because it needs the capital and has no access to equity markets. But if that's your reason, I can show it in your beta. I don't need to adjust for that by adding an arbitrary small cap premium. And it's true, there is no country risk premium. But my defense, it's a U.S. company. Why should there be a country risk premium? Because its revenues come from Brazil. Right? Yesterday, I had somebody who's valuing a company. This is an email that I got saying the company was in the Marshall Islands and that she could not find a risk premium for the Marshall Islands on my website. Could I please look it up and send it to her? So my email back was, what is the population of the Marshall Islands? See where I'm going with this? Why would you put your headquarters in the Marshall Islands? Because there's some tax issue you're getting, right? You're not selling your stuff in the Marshall Islands. You're selling it elsewhere. You might be selling it in Germany and Spain and Greece, for all I know. Your risk premium shouldn't come from where you're incorporated. It should come from where you do business. Let's keep going. Cost of debt. I divided the interest expense by the book value of debt. In fact, somebody in this class, I won't name them, last week emailed me saying, I don't like the cost of debt I'm getting from my synthetic rating. Can I replace it with a book interest rate? It looks more reasonable to me. What's wrong with using a book interest rate? First, within this cost of capital, there's a fundamental, even if you agree with all the numbers in there, there's a fundamental logical problem I'm facing. Nick, can you tell me what it is?
Well, what you did yesterday is not necessarily what you can do tomorrow.
And also, what's my risk-free rate according to my logic? It's 5%, right? What am I saying my pre-tax cost of debt is as a company? 3%. There's something fundamentally wrong here. If your risk-free rate is 5%, I can't borrow at less than 5%. If you say, no, the T-bond rate is really 3%, then you can't change your mind in the middle of your cost of capital calculation. Your book interest rate can be lower than the risk-free rate because it's not constrained. And here's the other thing. Even if interest rates don't change, you know how I can make my book interest rate look really low? Play the term structure. Play the term structure in what sense? If I replace all my long-term debt with short-term debt, are you going to give me a lower cost of debt and a higher value? That's a recipe for disaster. So no book interest rate. Let's keep going. We found so many mistakes, might as well complete the process. What's wrong with the tax rate he used? He used an effective tax rate when he should be using a marginal tax rate. Again, give me the reason. Why should I use a marginal tax rate when it comes to cost of debt? You don't even need the long term for cost of debt because interest expenses saves you taxes where? At the margin. That's all you need. It's actually an incredibly powerful argument because it means Apple can have an effective tax rate of 21% because it's got global income. But guess where it borrows money? It borrows money in the U.S. It offsets the interest expense against U.S. income. It gets a 40% tax saving on the debt. It's a marginal tax rate. Last piece, I used all liabilities. Because I wanted to be conservative. Is that conservative, though, to count all this stuff as debt? What does it do? It pumps up my debt ratio and decreases my cost of capital. So when you look at debt, what should be in there? Only interest-bearing debt and leases, if you do have leases. Okay? Present value of lease commitments. So I redid the cost of capital. So these are my replacements. The risk-free rate, I went back to 3%. For the beta, I went with the sector-adjusted average. I replaced the historical premium with an implied premium. I got rid of the small cap premium and used the premium for Brazil, but I multiplied by the percentage of revenues from Brazil. For my cost of equity, I got a much higher cost of equity, 15.68%, in spite of using a lower risk-free rate. For my cost of debt, I used a synthetic rating, which gave me this really high cost of debt, which actually makes sense for the company. I used a marginal tax rate. I used debt ratios and equity ratios based on market value. My cost of capital for this company, based on those replacement numbers, was 12.6%, not 8.05%. Okay. So when you look at a cost of capital calculation, start taking it apart, right? Pick up an acquisition valuation, see how the cost of capital is computed. You know. Yes?
Question about the cost of debt.
Yeah.
So
using... You weren't the one who emailed me about the book interest rate, was it? Oh, okay. Okay, go ahead, sorry. Right.
So I use interest coverage ratio, interest.
You had negative operating income?
EBIT over, over interest. But I thought that the interest payments were very low because they pretty much had very low cost of debt, book cost of debt. So I thought that was also reflected in their interest expense. And so the synthetic rating that I got was pretty high.
But wouldn't the same factors make your book interest rate really low too? The factors that are keeping your interest expense low, which is giving you the, will also make your book interest rate really low as well, right? So
yeah.
If you want to get out of this,
you're saying, so like both, I didn't see that
so,
grading that helped like do a better job.
You know what you can do? Take the book debt that you have.
Yeah.
Just apply, you know, take the risk-free rate and apply it to the book debt just to get a kind of, if an interest expense that's more in the ballpark. Use that. That'll actually, because anytime you have a lot of short-term debt, you're using commercial paper or interest, low interest bearing, you can make your interest expense look low relative to your book debt. You can make your synthetic rating look high. And if you don't have lease commitments, you can end up with this AAA rating for a company that you know has no chance of ever getting a AAA rating. So if you're struggling with the cost of debt, the book interest rate is almost never going to get you out of there. It's always going to lead you into darker places than you were leaving. So try to stay within the market process of estimating cost of debt. In fact, what you're asking is, if I went into the bank today, right? So even if they have short-term debt, if you can get a spread in the short-term debt, use that spread to add on to the risk-free rate to come up with a long-term cost of debt. Let's talk about growth. So let's assume that you are valuing a company, and I'm the management of the company. So you decide to take the lazy way out. You ask me to supply cash flows to you. Very dangerous thing to do because managers are not the best sources for cash flow. So I give you the numbers. And remember, the minute you ask for the numbers, you're trapped because I'm the management. I know more about the company than you do. So you're going to be questioning me from a position of weakness because I know more about the business than you do. But here's the question I need you to. So I've given you the numbers. Ask me some questions about my forecast for this company to make sure that I'm not coming up with unrealistic numbers. So let's start with the growth rate. How do you decide whether a growth rate is too high, too low, or reasonable? What are some of the questions you need to ask me? Because I can put in 10, then I can try 20, then I can try 25, 40, 50, 80, 100. I can keep going, right? But what am I constrained by? There is a market here. So one of the questions you might ask me, what's the total market? What's your market share? If my market share is 83% already, then putting in a 10% growth rate, if the market's growing 3%, is going to kill me. If my market share is 10 and I'm going up to 35%, you can say, well, how are you increasing your market share? Are you cutting prices? What's creating this higher market share? So even though you might not directly confront me on the growth rate, you can at least put the number for the market in front of me and saying, what are you assuming about your competitive position that's allowing you to estimate the growth rate that you are? First. Second, I gave you the rest of the numbers as well, right? Depreciation, CapEx, change in working capital. Am I making assumptions that are consistent with my growth rate? Or what can you do to kind of check that? What portion of my after-tax operating income am I reinvesting back each year? In fact, I've kept the portion fixed. So out of my 30, in fact, simple way to say it, look at the free cash flow to the firm. Free cash flow to the firm is 80% of my EBIT times 1 minus T. So I'm reinvesting 20%, right? You're saying, so what? What's the growth rate, I'm assuming? 10%. So hit me with the question. In fact, don't ask me what's my return on capital. Ask me what I'm doing that's giving me a return on capital of 50%, right? Do you see where the 50% comes from? 10 divided by 20. And I'm going to say, what return on capital? I never assumed a return on capital. I might not have. I might not even thought about it. But my growth rates and my reinvestment rate give you my imputed return on capital. And if you have last year's return on capital for the company and it's 12%, the question you're going to ask is, what's changed in this company? You used to make 12%. You seem to think you can make 50%. So the next time you see forecasted numbers for a company, start digging. Start digging into the growth rate. Start digging into reinvestment to see if, in fact, those numbers are feasible. Let's talk about changing the debt ratio. Let's say you're valuing a company. Make it Hormel Foods, the Spam company. 90% equity, 10% debt is where they are right now. They're a very conservative management. Their cost of capital right now is 6.8%. You believe, based on the assessment for the company, that the target debt ratio for this company is 30%. It's pure mechanics. If I asked you to compute the cost of capital at that target debt ratio, even if you can't give me a number, go through the sequence of steps you need to go through. What would you need to do to compute the cost of capital at a 30% debt ratio? Can I just replace the weights with 0.7 and 0.3? If I could, then debt is always going to help me, right? Because I'm. So what do I have to do? What's the first thing, Joseph?
Well, you have to figure out how much your cost of debt is going to go.
Okay, so you'll have to ask me at a 30%. If I'm going to triple my debt, and you know the direction it's going to go, right? What's going to happen to my cost of debt if I go from 10 to 30? It's going to go up because no bank is going to lend me money at the same rate if I'm going to triple my debt. What about the cost of equity? It'll go up as well, but how would I estimate how much it'll go up? Remember, the cost of equity was estimated based on a beta. The right beta that I'm using right now reflects a debt-to-equity ratio of 1 over 9, 11%. After this recap, my debt ratio is going to be 42%, or debt-to-equity ratio is going to be 42%. I have to unlever the beta and re-lever it back up, which gives me a higher cost of equity. Let's say I did that. My cost of capital at my target is 6.6%. So you now have two costs of capital. One is the cost of capital at the actual debt ratio. One is at the target debt ratio. Which one should I use in valuing Hormel Foods? The cost of capital at the actual or the cost of capital at the target debt ratio? You want to try, Perrine?
I think you would do the target.
You'd use the target? Let's say I use the target. I'm going to get a higher value, right? Let's say it makes my stock undervalued. I buy the stock. It's actually, I don't have any power to do anything, right? I'm just an investor. The managers don't like to borrow money. Now, do you see the problem with using a target debt ratio if you're a passive investor? It's not your company. In fact, when can I use the target? What do I have to have the power to do?
Change
the debt ratio. You know when that's most likely? If I'm doing an acquisition, I'm a private equity investor. Then I can use the target because I set the debt ratio after I control the company. But if you're a passive investor, you're better off using the actual. What if the management is giving you signals that it plans to change to the target, but it's going to do it over time? Then what should I do? In other words, I'd start at 6.8% and say, okay, it's 5 years. I go 6.8 down to 6.6. Don't get all tricky here. Go 6.8, 6.76, 6.72, 6.68, 6.64, 5 years. Your cost of capital goes. It'll mean that your cost of capital varies over time. And the only thing you have to remember to do is when your cost of capital varies, remember to do present value. You have to take that compounded cost of capital. A little bit of a pain, but that's something to keep in mind. Let's get to that big number in every DCF valuation. So let's start with the question that I think everybody should know the answer to. The best way to compute a terminal value is to use a stable growth model and assume cash flows grow at a fixed rate forever. Use a multiple of EBITDA in the terminal year. Use the estimated liquidation value of the assets. In fact, let me change the question. What's the worst way to compute terminal value? Use a multiple. Tell me why. In fact, I was talking to somebody this weekend. I was at a party that I didn't want to be at. And this person actually teaches for training the street. And he cornered me. That is exactly the word to use. The corner of the room. I'm trying to get away. No doors in any direction. Yeah? He says, what is this you're doing about terminal value? We tell our bankers that they should use multiples. They come back to us and they say that you say you shouldn't use multiples. What's wrong with using multiples? And the answer, of course, is that's like being a Buddhist in the morning and a Muslim in the afternoon. Midday, you're going to face a crisis of faith, the one way or the other. Okay? You either have to price things or you have to value them. You cannot mix the two up in the same valuation. Because basically, that's what you've done. That 6x EBITDA came from looking at comparable companies. You want to do it? Do it. Don't bring it into an intrinsic valuation because then you have something that's neither fish nor fowl. So let's build on that. Let's say you've been asked to value a business. The business expects to generate $120 million in after-tax earnings and cash flow every year in perpetuity. So how can the two be equal? There's no growth. The company's cost of equity is 10% and it has no debt. What's the terminal value of the business or what's the value of this business? $120 million, constant cash flow forever, discount rate is 10%, so the value is, what's the present value of perpetuity? Cash flow divided by discount rate, which gives me 120 divided by 0.1, which is 1.2 billion. Everybody with me? So it's no growth, cost of equity is cost of capital. Now let's assume you were told that the cash flows grow at, or the earnings grow at 2% a year forever. What's the value of this company? If you're stuck in pure mechanics, what does it look like? Magic. Because here's what happens. You got 120 divided by 0.10 minus 0.02, which is 1.5 billion. Why stop? Make it 4%, 2 billion, 6%, 3 billion. This is how terminal values get out of hand. But what's wrong with what I've just done? When I put in a growth rate, what else is going to change? My reinvestment in the first... When I had zero growth, I assumed earnings were equal to cash flows. When I have 2% growth, I can no longer do that. Why not? Because to get the 2% growth rate, I need to reinvest. How do I figure out how much I need to reinvest? What's the extra input I need to ask for? What's my return on capital? If my return on capital is 10%, guess what? My value as a company will stay fixed at 1.2 billion. Because here's what's going to happen. To grow at 2% a year, I've got to reinvest 20% back. 20% of 120 million is 24 million. You subtract that out, 96 divided by 0.08 is 1.2 billion. I grow at 4%, value stays at 1.2 billion. The key driver of value in the terminal value calculation is not your growth rate, but the return on capital that goes with that growth rate. We had a weekly challenge on it. Almost every exam, every quiz, we've gone over this issue. But I want to make sure it gets nailed down because if nothing else comes out of this class, that's the one thing that I hope that you remember about terminal values. Growth has to be paid for whether you're a high growth company or a stable growth company. Now let's see how much you remember of your quiz two stuff. Right? Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to take free cash flows, discount at the cost of capital, come up with a present value of 100 million. Then I'm going to throw items at you. And here's what I want you to tell me with each item, whether you want to add the item, subtract the item, or ignore the item. Ready? So I've got 100 million as my present value of free cash flows at the cost of capital. Cash balance of 15 million. Add, subtract, ignore to get to value of equity. Add. Tell me why. Why should I add?
Because it's operating assets.
It's not because it's not part of my operating income. So the key criterion here of to add, subtract, or ignore is have I counted it already? But I use free cash flow to the firm, which is based on operating income. Interest from cash is not part of operating income, so I'm going to add the 15 million. Somebody keep tabs as we go along. So 100 plus 15 is 150. I have debt outstanding of 20 million. Add, subtract, or ignore to get to equity. Subtract because it's money that I don't. So that was easy. 115 minus 20 is 95. I have a 5% holding in another company. The book value of the holding is 5 million. But the market value of equity in that company is $200 million. Add, subtract, or ignore. Now we're getting into cross-holdings, right? Maybe I should put a problem on cross-holdings for final exam. Add, subtract, or ignore. Go with it. I said, add, come out of, so add, okay. Why? Because it's not part of my EBIT, right? Because it's a 5% holding another company. It's a minority holding. It's not been counted yet. And what should I add? The book value or the... 5% of the market value. Or better still, 5% of the intrinsic value if I had it. But since I don't have it, 5% of the market value. Is everybody comfortable with that? If you haven't counted it already, you need to add. If you've counted it already, then you can ignore. If it's something that doesn't belong to you, you need to subtract. What if you have a minority interest of $10 million in the balance sheet? Add, subtract, or ignore. But first, what does it mean? When you see a minority interest in your balance sheet, what does it tell you? You have a majority stake in another company. The minority interest is the portion of the company that doesn't belong to you. And you acted like it belonged to you when you did the free cash flow of the firm because of consolidation. Because it doesn't belong to you, you need to take it out. Again, you'd prefer to take out the value of the intrinsic value of the 30 or 40% that doesn't belong to you. If you don't have that, then you're stuck with the book value, which is what minority interest is. But remember that divide. Minority holdings in other companies you need to add because you haven't counted them in. But minority interest you need to subtract out because you've overcounted with the 100%. You could, if the market value of the what? If you had the market value of that. If it's not publicly traded, though, you're not going to get a market value. But if you do have a market value, then you can subtract out the 30 or 20 or 40%. That will be a market value of the minority interest that you subtract. In fact, what's best is to have intrinsic value for everything. Second best is market value. Third best is book value. Okay? So go down the layers. You have to work with what you have. So the value of equity in the firm will be 100 plus 15 minus 20 plus 10. You're keeping track, right? Minus 10, which would be 95 million. Is that right? I think it's 95. So value of equity in this company is 95 million. How would your answer change if you were told that this company is the target of a lawsuit, that if it loses the lawsuit, it would have to pay out 100 million? Sounds like the equity is worth nothing, right? But what's the number you're going to ask me? What's the probability that I will lose the lawsuit? If I say it's 0%, you can ignore it. If I say it's 100%, you can say equity is worth nothing. If I say it's 20%, you're going to take 20% of 100 million and subtract it from the 95 million to come up with the value of equity. Mop up those loose ends because they can make a big difference in your valuation. Now let's talk about the value of equity. Let's say you come up with the value of equity in your company by doing a discounted cash flow valuation of 200 million. Let's start with the easy question first. If you have 10 million shares outstanding, what's your value per share? $20 per share, right? Now let's assume that I forgot to mention that the company has 2 million employee options outstanding with a strike price of $20 a share and 5 years to maturity. I'm not going to ask you for an exact answer. But will your value per share be, remember it was $20 before I told you this? Will your value per share be lower than $20, higher than $20, or unchanged given this additional information? It's going to be lower. But why? The options are at the money. Because there are options, right? They can be at the money, but you have 5 years left to maturity. And to do it right, I need to value those options as options. The 2 million options, and then do what? Subtract it from the 200 million, and then divide by what? Not 22 million, but 20 million shares. Don't double count, right? There is that treasury stock approach. I know it's very confusing. The treasury stock approach, here's what you do. You take the exercise proceeds from the options, add them onto your value of equity, and divide by 22 million. But if you have the value of the options, you subtract the value of the options, and you divide by the 20 million. So look at the problem. If you have the information on the value of the options, then go the right approach. If you don't, then of course you're stuck using the treasury stock approach. And the final layer of hell, you remember it was the start of the class test, going back, I think, session 3. It's that first Boston valuation of Carborundum, the target company, where they used the wrong company's wrong discount rate to value cash flows. The cash flows that they computed were cash flows after debt payments. And the cash flows are after debt payments to target company. The discount rate you should use is what? First, because they're after debt payments, the discount rate should be the cost of equity or capital? Cost of equity, because these are post-debt cash flows. And because the target company, and we did this in acquisition, the discount rate has to be the discount rate for the target company. The right cost of equity to you, the right discount rate would have been the 16.5%. What they used instead was the 10.5%, which is the cost of capital for the acquiring company, which is about as far from the right answer as you can get. But that's why the final layer of hell is reserved for anybody who mismatches cash flows and discount rates. Because this is how you can make multi-billion dollar mistakes, right? Mismatching in currencies, mismatching in claims, mismatching of any type is extraordinarily dangerous in terms of the value effect it has. So that was my way of reviewing the material. Now let me show you what you found on your project. I'll tell you up front, though, that these are your numbers. If there's anything strange, they're your numbers. Okay? So if you do something based on these numbers and you lose money, don't sue me. I'll give you the name of the person who sent the numbers. Just send me an email. I'll reveal everything right off the top. Right? Privacy, forget about it. Right? So let's start with what models you used. It's no contest. 90% of you use free cash flow to the firm. And that doesn't surprise me. That gives you the maximum flexibility. So about 7% use free cash flow to equity and 3% use dividends, which also tells me something about how many of you valued banks and insurance companies and investment banks, because that's the dividend discount model right there. Here's what you found. So basically, I took companies and I broke them down into undervalued by more than 50%. Okay? Your median company was overvalued by about 18.37%. So this is your DCF value compared to your price across the 111 companies for which I had the data. I think, in summary, 69 companies came out as overvalued, according to you, and 32 came out as undervalued, and 7 were kind of close enough, but no, predominantly overvalued companies. Okay. So the average is much higher than the median because you had no one significantly overvalued company, I guess. But you can see the graph is tilted out towards overvalue. Now, usually when you show this graph for intrinsic valuation models, people say, that's understandable. Intrinsic value models are conservative. I'm going to show you another table later on that's not the case. But in this class, at least, you are more likely to find companies to be overvalued than undervalued. Every semester, I take your list and I come up with the 20 most undervalued and 20 most overvalued. Before I show you this list, though, to tell you that every semester that I've taught this class, I've bought one stock based on the undervalued list. I don't do anything with the overvalued list. I'll let you guys deal with it. So here's your most undervalued companies. And one of these companies is going to end up in my portfolio. I'll tell you in a minute which one. Okay? So those are your most undervalued, 20 most undervalued companies. I've listed out your recommendations saying that's pretty obvious. If they're undervalued, they're going to be buys. That's not always the case. Okay? Depends on how much confidence you have in your own valuation. So, but these were your most undervalued. Fiat Chrysler came out as the most undervalued company. And Moleskine came out as the 20th most undervalued company. You're saying, which one am I going to buy? I'm going to send an email out after this class. And here's the question I'm going to ask you. If you're on this list, it's a very simple one. Are you buying? If you say no, it's off the list right off the way. If you say, I'm thinking about it, off the list right off the way. Maybe off the list right off the way. If you say yes, though you could lie about this, I have no way of checking, then it goes on my list. So if I say three of you say I'm buying, then I wait to read your report to see which one of those three I will actually have the most faith in. Okay. But one of these will end up in my portfolio, and I'll give you the track record. There's a reason I do it. It's not out of charity. There's actually a purely commercial interest I have in doing this. Those are your most undervalued. Here are the most overvalued stocks. I don't even know what to do with that Sears. Should I go short and hope that the DCF value kicks in? Yeah. Incidentally, Amazon was valued by three people. They all found it overvalued to different degrees. This was the most overvalued. It shows up again as another sell, and a third sell. So the three people did Amazon. That was not always the case. Three people valued Netflix. Two found it undervalued. Two found it overvalued. One found it undervalued. But Amazon, all three found it overvalued. They all show up on my list. So those are my most overvalued stocks. Netflix shows up as one of the most overvalued, but it does show up as an undervalued company as well. So as I said, this is the 27th year that I've been teaching this class, and starting in about the third or fourth year, I started getting people to do this and keeping a record of what people were finding out is under or overvalued. And I usually don't start tracking these in terms of returns until I have about 5 years up, because the reason is discounted cash flow valuation is long term. So if I tell you next quarter that you didn't make any money, that's neither here nor there. So you can see that I've essentially taken different semesters. And basically what I've done is I've taken your recommendations, not the under overvalued, you buy, sell, or hold, and looked at the returns you'd have made relative to the S&P 500. For buy, sell, and hold. And across the period, the buys consistently outperform the S&P 500. The sells consistently underperform the S&P 500. Now, maybe we should create a mutual fund. Really low fees, right? Forget about the job offer you have. Let's create this. It looks like it. I mean, collectively, this is the law of large numbers. It's not like every buy is a good buy, but no. And in fact, when I look at these buy recommendations, about 60% of all buy recommendations make money. About 45% of sell recommendations beat the market as well. So there is noise in your recommendation process, which is to be expected. Okay? The average return on buy recommendations is about 4% higher than the average return on sell recommendations. So it's a little bit of a separation. It's not random, obviously. The excess return on buy recommendations for small cap and emerging market companies is higher than on the rest, which is to be. But here's the thing that I find most striking. If you look at where these excess returns are coming from, they come from one or two stocks every single semester. It's a very skewed distribution, and that's the way you make money on portfolios. Most of your companies will kind of tread water, keep up with the market. But that one big winner is really what's carrying your portfolio returns afloat. And here's the interesting fact. In many of these cases, the stock that delivered that huge return, if you track it 3 months or 6 months after the recommendation was made, actually went down. And that's why this is as much an issue of patience and faith as it is an issue of what do the numbers tell me. Because if you're impatient, guess what? You'd have sold Apple. The 99 recommendation that I got for Apple was about probably 6 to 9 months ahead of the curve in terms of having the stock turn around. But that's, I think, the nature of intrinsic valuation is you will be wrong for a while before you become right, even if you're right. And if you don't have the patience, you might be selling exactly the stock you should be holding on for the long term because it doesn't look that good in the first 3 or 6 months. Stocks that are undervalued on a DCF and a relative valuation basis tended to do better than stocks that are undervalued just on a DCF basis. I mean, often I'm asked why I care about pricing. If I'm so much of an intrinsic value person, why do I care about it? I'm not an intrinsic. I want to make money. That's really my ultimate objective. If intrinsic value delivers for me, I'm going to go with it. But if pricing helps me make more money, why would I turn it away? So don't make this an either-or. You can do both. You can fundamentally believe in intrinsic valuation, but that doesn't mean you shouldn't be pricing companies as well, because then you get a double whammy working in your direction, because if something is cheap on an undervalued basis and on a pricing basis, you seem to make more money than if it's undervalued just on a DCF basis. Now, when it comes to pricing, remember the four-step process for deconstructing multiples. Define. So when somebody says PE ratio is 8, make them pause and explain to you how they computed the PE ratio. They're going to have complete contempt for you. So you don't know what the PE ratio is? Say, Anna Kournikova knows what the P-E ratio is. I don't. Please tell me. Because you're going to be surprised at the variations here in EV to EBITDA, EV to invested capital, P. So define. Describe. Draw the histogram. You have the data. Why have rules of thumb? Draw on what's high, what's low, what's the median. Okay? Every time you use a multiple, whether you like it or not, embedded in that multiple are assumptions about the future, about growth and cash flows and risk. Don't fall for that old ploy of, I'm using a multiple because I don't want to make assumptions. You are making assumptions. And finally, when you think about using that multiple, think about that comparable set and make it as broad as you can. A larger sample of less comparable companies is better than a really small sample of companies that look just like yours. So if you remember this page, at the end of our multiples, that's what we did. We used the algebra and a discounted cash flow model to come up with the variables that determine each multiple. With equity multiples, we went back to a dividend discount model and extracted the variables that are price earnings, price to book, price to sales, whatever multiple. With an enterprise value multiple, we went back to a firm valuation model and built the algebra. You can use this very simple technique to break out what the variables are that drive each multiple. So here's what you did. A lot of EV multiples. EV to EBITDA, 26% of your companies used EV to EBITDA, 30% of the companies used EV to sales, and about 4-5% used EV to EBIT. EV to invested capital was 3%. PE ratio hung in there. Surprisingly robust in terms of people continuing to use it. Price to book was 10%. There's PEG ratios, or two people who use PEG ratios, and then there were a few fairly creative multiples. I think there was one enterprise value per patent. A biotechnology company, so basically enterprise value scale to something. I think there's one company which is enterprise value per user. So different variations, the multiple, to come up with it. So here's what I did also. For each of your companies, I asked for a DCF value and a relative value. So these are your DCF and relative values. I compared your DCF value to your own relative value, just to see which one was higher. The median number is really the number to focus on because there's one big outlier. On average, your DCF value is about 92% of your relative value. That statistic, historically, has been around 100% in this class. This semester, DCF value is... The reason it's around 100% is because I kind of force you there. You know how? What's the number in your DCF valuation that I use to make your DCF values and your relative values converge? I make you use an implied equity risk premium. You see how that's going to force convergence? The implied equity risk premium comes from looking at the market today. So by forcing you to use that premium, I'm kind of... But this semester, in spite of forcing you to use that premium, your DCF values came in at 8% below the relative values. And on a relative value basis, here's your list of most undervalued companies. Notice, though, that your most undervalued company is Caesars, but what's the recommendation? Sell, which means you have a DCF valuation that pushed you in the other direction. Right? So you see a lot more mixed results here because your DCF valuation is driving your primary strategy. This is kind of a backup. Yeah? So Lionsgate shows up twice, but it's really the same. Some of you sent in your summaries two times, three times. I think one group sent it five times. By the time you sent it the fifth time, I couldn't even find the first time you sent it. So I started ignoring the fourth and the fifth time. So those are your most undervalued. Here are your most overvalued. Solar City is up there, 1,744% overvalued. You had a tough time even getting a value, I would think, for that on a relative value basis. Okay? So those are the most overvalued stocks. Zynga was also valued by three different people. All three found it overvalued. All three put a sell recommendation on it. So it's there. Amazon shows up as overvalued too. Yeah. Now, there were only a dozen of you who were able to use the option pricing model because remember the conditions you need, money-losing company with a lot of debt, most of you did not have. For those 12 people who were able to use an option pricing model, that option pricing model gave them a 70% premium over the DCF valuation, which makes sense because the optionality kicks in. Okay. Now, once you have the value for your company, if I ask you to change it, and we kind of talked about this last session, you've got to either change the cash flows, the growth rate, the discount rate, or how long you can grow. And we talked about how to use an intrinsic valuation model to make those changes. That's the last session, was all about changing those. Now, I didn't get a chance to get to this in the last session, so I want to at least kind of embark on it. There are one of the richest areas in consulting, one of the most lucrative aspects of consulting is called value consulting. McKinsey has it, BCG has it, you know. So this isn't the kind of IT consulting, this is actually value consulting, where you talk to the top management and you tell them what they need to do to increase value. Now, McKinsey actually uses an old-fashioned DCF model to present their case. But most consulting firms create their own little acronyms. Okay? CFROI, EVA, essentially arguing that we've discovered a magic bullet which is much better than DCF valuation, just use us instead. Okay? So the reason they push this is it makes them look special, and the plus they argue is it's much simpler than a DCF model. Just focus on your EVA or a CFROI, and if it goes up, you've done well as a company. There is that advantage, but it comes with a disadvantage. Every one of these simplistic or more simpler ways of enhancing value makes some assumptions about DCF valuation. Those assumptions can get you into trouble. I'll use EVA to kind of illustrate the point. EVA was concocted, invented, created as a mechanism by a firm called Stern Stewart. About 25 years ago, a New York-based consulting firm came up with this measure called EVA. And EVA is just very simply the difference between return on capital and cost of capital multiplied by the book value of invested capital. So it's the excess return as multiplied by the invested capital. And Stern Stewart was incredibly successful in pushing this, or selling this. Pushing this is too strong a word, in selling this to companies. So here's what they do. They'd go into a Fortune 500 or a large market cap company. They'd go to the CEO and say, you know what, you're probably all very confused about this discounted cash flow stuff. Too many things to keep your eye on. We've come up with a much better way in which you can manage your company. It's this number, EVA. Every morning, we'll put the number in front of you. And all you have to do is increase that number. And if you make that number higher, you're making your company more valuable. Sounds good, right? So your CEO, you fall for it. And by the mid-90s, half of the Fortune 500 companies were using some variant of EVA. You're saying, how does Stern Stewart make money? Don't worry, they figured out a way. First, what did I say EVA was? Return on invested capital minus cost of capital times capital invested, right? They came up with 64 adjustments you have to make to get the return on invested capital, right? And they were all proprietary. You know what that means, right? Every 3 months, you have to call Stern Stewart in to tell you what your return on invested capital is. Great business model. And CEOs were compensated based on delivering higher EVA this year than last year. You're saying, what's wrong with this? We want companies to deliver higher return on capital. Here's the problem. When you focus in on a shortcut, which is what this is, you're going to encourage game playing. So here are some of the games that managers play. The first is what I call the growth game. What am I rewarding you on? Are you delivering a higher return on invested capital this year versus last year? See, if you can cut out expenses that are really designed to deliver future growth. I'll give you an example. I know at least three of you did Netflix, and one of the things that you probably saw with Netflix, anybody here in the class, when you looked at their commitment columns, what did you see as a big commitment?
Acquisition of content.
Streaming content, right? It's the biggest cost by far. What is it for? Well, when you pay an $8 subscription for Netflix, what do you hope to see when you go into that entry page? A lot of movies that you can watch, a lot of TV. This is basically their way of lining up the content so that if you wanted to see Lost, you could see every episode. I don't think Lost is even on Netflix yet, but whatever it is, they're paying for the content. That content right now is expensed. If they cut that content down to zero this year, they'll report higher operating income this year. But you know what's going to happen? You're a member of Netflix, you say, well, nothing new seems to be showing up here. In about 6 or 9 months, you're going to start to see the membership rolls fall off and new people will not join. They've destroyed the most valuable asset, which is growth, to deliver higher operating income this year. You're saying no CEO would be stupid enough to do it? Well, if I offer you a huge bonus and options for delivering higher EVA this year as opposed to last year, I'm encouraging you to play this game. The second game is what I call the risk game. What am I measuring? How much you earn over and above your cost of capital, right? So let me offer you a very simple choice. Would you rather earn a 1% spread over an 8% cost of capital, from a pure value perspective, or a 1.5% spread on a 12% cost of capital? Turns out that the 1% spread on an 8% cost of capital is more valuable than the 1.5% spread on a 12% cost of capital. And the way to do it is actually put in the numbers, get the present value. So from a value perspective, I'd much rather that you earn the 1% spread over the 8% cost of capital. But if I judge you based on dollar EVA, delivering the 1.5% spread at a 12% cost of capital will deliver a higher EVA than a 1% spread at a lower cost of capital. So that's a game again you're going to play. And here's the third game. This is all about what I call invested capital, which means if you can figure out a way to borrow money without it showing up as part of invested capital, you're going to do it. And in the mid-90s, the game was, hey, let's lease stuff. Let's not borrow money and buy stuff. It'll make our invested capital low, our return on capital high. It'll look like we delivered great returns. But these guys were master salespeople. Bennett Stewart and Joel Stern, who founded Stern Stewart, could sell refrigerators to Eskimos, especially Bennett Stewart. He could sell anything to anybody. His corporate finance expertise was about this deep, but it didn't need it. You know, he could sell. And I remember the first time I tangled with him was actually in Europe somewhere on a value enhancement panel. I was on the panel, Tim Kohler, who's the co-writer of the McKinsey book, was on the panel. Raleigh Thomas, who used to work at Holt Associates, which had CFRO, I was on the panel, and Bennett Stewart was there. And I had this misfortune of being the master of ceremonies, basically, I'd not say anything and just be in the background, role I hate. So each person got up, so Tim Kohler got up first, and he gave a very measured presentation on when McKinsey, we use DCF models to estimate value, then Raleigh Thomas talked about CFRO, its pluses and minuses. And Bennett Stewart got up, and he held up an annual report for Coca-Cola. These are all European CEOs. He said, do you want to be like Coca-Cola? Coca-Cola uses EVA. This is like one of those high school, logic classes. And then he left it there because basically here's what he was saying. If you want to be like Coca-Cola, Coca-Cola uses EVA. If you use EVA, you'll be Coca-Cola. Pissed me off no end, but nothing I could do there. So I waited my moment. And it came. About a year later, there was a New York panel on value enhancement. Unfortunately, Bennett Stewart wasn't there, but somebody from Stern Stewart was there. He got up and this must be a ploy that they try everywhere. He held up the Coca-Cola annual report and said, do you want to be like Coca-Cola? Coca-Cola uses EVA. And this time I had a chance to actually say something. So I got up, it was my turn, and I took my shoes off, and I bought these new Nike shoes, I put them on. And I sat down and started eating a bowl of Wheaties. And people said, what the heck is this guy doing? And I got up and I said, I'm wearing my Air Jordans. I've eaten my Wheaties. Could somebody point me towards a basketball hoop? I'd like to slam dunk a basketball. For those of you who need to know this, my jumping ability is like 40. The only thing that I can slam dunk is a Fisher-Price kids. That's about it. I can wear the most expensive shoes in the world, eat all the Wheaties in the world. I'm not going to get within 2 feet of that basketball hoop. And the point I was trying to make was, hey, just because you use EVA doesn't mean that you're going to become a value-enhancing company, because it's just a measurement device. That's all EVA is, and it's not a very good one at that. But lots of these consulting firms push towards that because, that's what you want. So when you think about valuation, here's something that you want. Now that you have a value for your company, here are three things that you're probably going to say. First is, you might say, I'm not sure yet. But that's something that you're never going to get over. So you've got to figure out a way to get over that. Okay? Maybe maybe at this point you're saying, look, there's no point. I can't really beat the market. In which case, go to an index fund and that. Or you can draw on the fact that you don't have to be right on every investment. If on average you're bringing something to the table, you're hoping that on average you can take something away. That's the attitude I have about valuations. I never go into a company saying, I got the value right, I deserve to make money on this stock. There is no deserve to in this process. But it is faith. I can't prove it. And maybe one of these days I'll wake up and have no faith. In which case, no point sticking with something if you have no faith. But that's something that drives valuation. So I took all your recommendations, buy, sell, hold. Sorry, the axes go from earliest to latest. So each semester I keep track of buy, sell, hold. Okay? And then I look at the buy to sell ratio. So that ratio is high, a lot more buys than sells. So the buy ratio peaked, you can see the peaks. That was in 2002, there's a peak in 2009, there's a mini peak in 2012. And it hit a bottom in 2007, it kind of dropped off in 2010. And then you have 2015. Either you guys are the most pessimistic bunch on the face of the earth, or I should be selling everything and running for the hills. Hey, this is the lowest buy-sell ratio I've ever recorded in this class. And that's scary because it's, you know, it's because it's again the law, it's not one person's pessimism. It's the fact that collectively you don't, you know, you think that stocks are overvalued. Maybe there's something there, right? I'm going to leave you with one final page, and this kind of summarizes. No. Because if you ask me what's the right approach for me, it depends on what job you do, where you end up. So whether you end up in intrinsic valuation or trading, it's up to you. But here are the final lessons I hope that you can take away. First, remember, the more things change, the more they stay the same. This is all about the fundamentals. Return to the basics anytime you get confused. Cash flows, growth, and risk. Second, think about the big picture. Lots of individual details that go into your valuation. Remember we talked about narratives? Work on that. If you're a story person, work on your number crunching. If you're a number crunching person, work on your storytelling. Force yourself to do it because you will get better over time. Don't let anecdotal evidence drive investing. There's so much stuff that happens out there that people kind of draw on anecdotes and make them the part of their investment story. And final two things. If you ever let things get to you, keep reminding yourself it's only a valuation. It's only money. I remember about 6 or 7 years ago, at the end of one of these classes, second year MBA comes up to me and she said, I never thought this would happen, but I have a job as a sell-side equity research analyst. It's a history major from Yale who came back for an MBA, and usually you take the strategic MBA route. You know what that is? Pick every class with the word strategic in its name. You can go 2 years in this program without ever seeing a number, right? You say, I never knew this. Well, by accident, she ended up in this class, and it's not a strategic valuation class. She turned out to be really good at it. So she said, no, I've got a job as a sell-side equity research analyst. I said, congratulations. She said, I'm really scared. I said, what are you so scared about? She said, what if I make a mistake? I said, be glad you're not a brain surgeon. Make a mistake, somebody dies on the table. You make a mistake, what's the worst that's going to happen? Somebody gets a little richer, somebody else gets a little poorer. Just make that somebody else who gets a little poorer not be you. Make it somebody else. Think like a Marxist. You move some money around, it's not end of the world. Move on. Nothing in valuation is worth losing sleep over. And final point, I hate to let you in on this, but the dominant paradigm in this business, much as we'd like to think it's skill and patience, is luck. Which means if you're lucky, you could screw up big time. You could do horrible valuations and still make money. If you're not, you could do everything right and you're screwed. It's predestined. You're going to lose money. It's brought home to me by my mother-in-law when she came to visit in early 2000. She became an avid investor in the 1990s, which to me should have been a sign that the market was topping off. Kind of missed that sign. She came to visit. She'd drive us crazy. She'd watch CNBC all day. She made it a spectator sport. And every time one of her stocks would go on the ticker, she'd cheer it on. Go, Cisco, go. And convinced us it was actually pushing. Look, it went up. And all day long, all she would talk about what was in her portfolio, what was out of her portfolio, what she wished was in, what she wished was out. You'd act like you were listening. That's what son-in-laws do. But then she let it slip. She owned Qualcomm, one of the great stocks of 99, up 600%. I was impressed. I said, Judy, why do you pick Qualcomm? I knew the minute I asked this question I shouldn't have, because she told me. She said she picked Qualcomm because it owned MCI. I said, that's not Qualcomm, that's WorldCom. She said, Qualcomm, WorldCom, what's the difference? I said, you picked the wrong company. If you really meant to buy the company that owns MCI, you'd have lost money. Instead, you buy some other company that rhymes with it and make 600%. I was afraid to ask her after that why she owns Cisco, afraid the answer might be that she really likes their vegetable oil. Or Saturday Night Live, who knows what drove that particular decision. But after she left, I did try a strategy. I'd pick a stock in the news, pick one that rhymes with it. Didn't work for me. If it had, forget about this intrinsic value stuff. Who needs that, right? So I wish you the very, very best, and I will see you at the exams.